So my background is fairly varied. I've done underwriting. I've done network development. I help build networks at our organization. I worked for, as Dennis said, I worked for a provider-sponsored health plan in Akron, Ohio, up until December of this last year. And now I'm working, just recently took a position in Greenville, South Carolina. I'm still in Ohio. Cavs are playing tonight, so that's the one good thing. So I'm now in Greenville, South Carolina. And so one of the things I want to talk about is the experiences. And then I was also responsible for, we called it our TPA, internal TPA. The term we'd be using here is ASO. I want to focus on the term self-funding and think of the funding mechanism of these products and not get hung up on the term ASO, TPA, those kinds of things, because what really comes down to the employer is how well you're able to assist them in administering this employee benefit plan that they take a lot of credit to, or that they look at on a very close basis, because every week you send them a funding request for money versus a premium. And I've tried to come up with an example of why a self-funded employer seems to be more interested in managing the operations of you on their behalf versus if you're a premium-based product. And so, because if you're a premium-based product, you're still paying a lot of money out of your 500-shop employee company, and you're paying this premium every month. That should be a very big ticket item. Yet you pay this very small administrative fee, relatively speaking, to a premium, and yet they are constantly calling when anything slightly goes wrong. And I think it's because of that weekly funding that they say, this week it was $300,000. Next week it's $200,000. The next week it's $1 million. And so there's a lot of variability. And so the best analogy that I've come up with, and tell me if you like this analogy, is if you're a golfer and you do your research up front to say, what kind of set of clubs do I want to buy? Do I want to buy Callaway? Do I want to buy Nike? Nike doesn't exist anymore in the club business, sorry. Do I want to buy TaylorMade? Whatever. Versus, I'm going to make my own set of clubs. So I'll do that research up front to say, here's the set of clubs I want to purchase, buy that set of clubs, and I'm done. I don't really spend any more time worrying about how well the club performs. My game's crummy to begin with, so I just say it's me, not the club. Versus the person who creates that golf club, they're looking at the type of material in the shaft, they're looking at the angle of that club head. They're looking at the grip that they put on there, and they're constantly tweaking that after every round of golf, and they're constantly doing research. I think that claim, weekly claim submission to them, is that constant reminder of their game that things need to be tweaked. What are they doing? And so that's why I think when you get into the self-funded product line, you have to, and I like the phrase, I wrote down de-HMOizing or undoing that. You really have to do that, and that's what we'll talk about here. So I just simply wanted to start with an example of a formal definition of self-funding, and I won't read it to you, but the piece that I find interesting is the first phrase. It says a group health self-insurance program for large employers. This definition's already outdated, and no disrespect to this organization. But as we've talked about, and as you'll see in the marketplace, there are programs to go down to 25 employees. So I think if you have the old definition of self-funding of large employers, it used to be 500 employees and above. I mean, when we started in 2001 on the self-funding side, we said 100. And after a while, my CFO came to me and said, can we bump that to 200 or 300? And I said, why do you want to bump it all the way up to 300? Well, we're not making enough money. And I said, well, that's not the solution. The solution is to figure out why we're not making the money on the 300, on the 100 to 200, and now it's all the way down to 25. So that's something to take into account. From the Willis Towers Watson survey, I want to point out the following, that in their last survey, they asked their employers, how many of you think you'll still be offering health insurance or employee benefit plan coverage over the next 10 years? So you'll see the low is in 2012. And 2012 is significant because it was shortly after ACA was introduced, March of 2010. I don't remember the exact date, but there was that whole issue about whether or not it was legal. They went to the Supreme Court. Could ACA still sustain itself? So because of the uncertainty, you saw this low in 23 with the Supreme Court decision that it is legal and those kinds of things. You start seeing a bump up. But in 2016, it's all the way up to 54% saying, we believe and expect to be offering employee benefits over the next 10 years. So that's a huge increase. That's significant. And as we've talked about earlier today, some of you say, you know, the question was asked, am I growing my business, my membership, or am I just replacing fully insured and moving it to self-funded? I would tell you that if all you're doing is moving from fully insured to self-funded, that is still a positive, because if you don't move them into the self-funded methodology, they're going to go somewhere else. So even a defensive strategy is one of the reasons to consider moving into the self-funded administration. Now, obviously to survive, we want to grow that business, have a net growth, but if you don't move them into the self-funded, they're going somewhere else because they've already made that decision to move into the self-funded business. Now, we've had great conversations about why would you self-fund, whether it's ASO versus TPA, and again, I think my personal perspective is the term ASO and TPA are mindsets. They're more of how are you approaching this product line, and we'll talk about that in one of my other slides, that this truly is this truly a product line for your company, or is it just a stumble in? I heard somebody say earlier that they would put out some self-funded quotes and occasionally somebody would bite at it and they'd sell it. I would tell you the way we started getting into the self-funded business is that we started as an HMO, provider-sponsored HMO, in the state of Ohio. That's not an insurance company. It was a prepaid health plan, so there were a lot less regulations, but you still had requirements, and we went out and sold this regional network HMO, and we were very successful. And so we'd go into, the salespeople would go into large employers, and they say, we like your brand, we like what you're doing, but we want to self-fund. So the sales rep, to their credit, would say, we can do that. Then they come back to the office and say, what's self-funding and how do we do it? And so it was more than stumbling. It was, we're making commitments and we didn't know what we were doing. So that's one of the things that over time we said, wait a minute, is this going to become a product line for us? And then I'll explain, if we have time, the history of why we moved it out from underneath our health plan and licensed it as a TPA. So some of the fundamental considerations for self-funding on the employer side, it was mentioned earlier, it's regulated by ERISA, and there are those exceptions that was pointed out. If you are a government entity or you're a religious organization, you're still governed by the state and regulated by the state. So you've got to have that mindset that just because it's self-funded, you have two different regulatory entities that you may be working with, the state you live in or the Department of Insurance. Then you have multiple state departments of insurance if you are near borders or your footprint crosses state lines. So for those kinds of clients, you've got to still act like you're a fully insured provider from a regulatory perspective. It's also ideal for large multi-location employers. So those employers that are domiciled in your market that have brand recognition, recognize you very well, they're a good client. You want to put them on your list because they're very important. They may have locations of 3 salespeople in 2 states away, or a shop that produces that does the research for them in another state. So even though you're going for the corporate headquarters that's in your footprint, you have to think about, okay, do they have other multi-locations? Because they're very interested in self-funding because they don't have to worry about state lines as far as their benefit plan is concerned. Reduced need for multiple carriers administrators. You're going to see another slide where I kind of contradict myself, and I'll explain that later. But one of the things that by crossing state lines, you don't have to buy a fully insured product in every state using a different carrier. So this creates ease from administration for these employers. And then the employer determines the plan. And so they have the flexibility to say, other than the ACA requirements, we don't want to cover this benefit, or we don't want to cover this benefit. If it's not illegal, then you don't have to cover that benefit. One of the challenges I've seen here is organizations, and this is particularly the BUCAs, they will tell the employer, and I had a very large client, a well-known name in Northeast Ohio, a hospital system, and they were with their largest payer, who brought them the most business, administered their employee benefit plan. It was the Cleveland Clinic, and we had them for 3 years, 26,000 employees. And so 52,000 members we were administering. And in the first, after the first year, or after the first quarter, they said to us, "You have been more accurate in administering our employee benefit plan in the first quarter than they did all the last 10 years that they administered our employee benefit plan." And what happens is the carriers many times will say, "Yeah, we'll administer that plan." And what they do is they go find a plan that's on the shelf that's as close as possible. And in my phrase, they jam it in there. And then they say, "This is your plan." And then when you turn around, you've got all these one-offs that aren't following the plan properly. And so that's something that you have to take into account. The question was asked, do you do a standard plan or do you do a customized plan? My position is for at least the 100 employees and above, and clearly 500 employees and above, you need to start with a blank piece of paper and assume you don't have a plan that they want to administer at this point in time. Now, there's another strategy that can be incorporated to help kind of keep some of the expenses down, is if they are in a certain size, maybe the 80 to 100, 80 to 200, you say, "Here are the three types of plans we have. If you pick this, here's the administrative pricing that goes with it. If you want full customization, here's the administrative pricing that goes with that." So you give them a little more choice to say, where do you want the price point to be? But once you hit 300 employees, they don't expect that kind of statement from you because they expect you or want you to customize it. And then desire for timely and consistent data. That is probably the biggest key. You've heard that statement earlier today. Steve mentioned that when he was fully insured, couldn't get the data from him to say, it's our data. What's happening with our employee benefit plan? I was in a meeting about 3-4 days ago with a potential client down in Greenville. And they use one of the BUCAs as their administrator, self-funded plan. And we're talking to them about doing a direct-to-employer provider contract and then working with their TPA. Well, their TPA is a BUCA. And the phrase he made in the meeting was, this potential client, is, "We've been trying to get Blue Cross's data to you so you can analyze their data and tell us what the claims are like." And I wanted to scream out in the meeting, it's not their data, it's your data. But I was polite. I didn't want to embarrass him in front of his colleagues. So after the meeting, I just politely said, "One of the things that we'll help you with is this is your data, and we'll be very transparent with it." So you need to understand, that's something that you can really bring to the table is if you promote that transparency, you promote the willingness to present reports, give them data in a reliable and timely fashion. Now, I tried to bullet point what are the challenges for us as that administrator. So the first bullet, are you willing to provide services outside your current market? What I mean by current market, if you have a 20-county footprint with your local network, provider-sponsored network, what are you going to do outside of that 20-county footprint to support these types of clients? You need to evaluate services you will provide outside your state service area. So if you have a multi-location site, can you do case management 3 states away? Can you do disease management 4 states away? Are you willing to provide those types of services? Can you provide network services to them 5 counties away? So those kinds of things. Willingness to allow a client to mandate plan design. And I use mandate specifically because you'll get in a very, I believe, testy conversation if you keep trying to move them back to one of your standard plans, because they're going to come to you and say, "This is what we've negotiated with the unions or the bargaining unit, or this is what we've done. This is what our consultant said we should be doing. We believe in this plan. Can you administer this or not?" And then the last one is the ability to provide that client with timely, meaningful, and replicable reports. So if anybody disagrees with me too, I'm happy to have that conversation in here as well. So I would like that feedback because, again, this is my experience over the last 15 to 16 years running our TPA and working with clients in Northeast Ohio. This is really the essence of this presentation in my mind. I've heard time and time again and within our own organization, well, let's get in the self-funded business because a claim is a claim is a claim. We've got all this investment in customer service. We've got all this investment in a claim system. We can start spreading these costs over more units. Let's do it. If that's your only reason to wanting to get in the self-funded business, I would advise you to run. Run away from that because you will make huge mistakes up front. So you've got to, as part of that strategy, to determine if a claim is a claim, is to balance the need for economies of scale, but that customization. I would recommend that if you're looking at this, or if you're currently in it, and you're taking fully insured people, and 3 days a week they're processing fully insured claims, and 2 days a week they're processing self-funded claims, that's not a good model, particularly on the customer service side. It's easy to learn plan ABC from a customer service perspective, or DEF, that you sell 30 or 40 times to different clients. All of a sudden you have Cleveland Clinic, they have four unique plans. You have University of Akron, and I'm giving you names of clients that we used to have as public knowledge. They have two different plans that are completely different from these other three. So there's a level of uniqueness, sophistication, and again, that whole concept that they are really monitoring your services much more closely than they ever did when you were selling them a fully insured product. Are you willing to unbundle your operational services? So we've talked about that. I heard the comment over here. We give them disease management. If I misquote you, please tell me. We give them UM. That's part of the secret sauce, to use those terms. That may not be your best strategy long term, because in the self-funded world, they're pretty used to unbundling. And I heard the comment, and I want to talk to the gentleman afterwards, about creating those bundles. That's a great idea. But the self-funded world is used to unbundling. And so they, as was said, they may have a national COBRA vendor. So if you say, you get COBRA with our services, whether you like it or not, they may not pick you because they feel like they're wasting money, even if it's 50 cents PEPM or $1 PEPM. So you've got to determine what are the core level of services you're willing to offer, and others that you're willing to plug in their preferred vendor. And can you plug in that preferred vendor? I mean, the phrase I heard earlier, it's easier to give them the service for free than to try to turn it off internally, because that internal work is so difficult to turn off. And I will tell you, we started out, as I said, as an HMO. And so I think some of the dilution over the years, that HMOs have not been as favorable in the communities as PPOs, it's helping to desensitize some of that. Here's how you administer a plan, and this is the only way. But I'm a firm believer that if you're in the self-funded business and you're health plan here, you're better off to probably hire some middle management that has been in a TPA, that thinks more like a TPA than they think like an insurance company, to bring that different mindset, that different concept. And then the best part is, you got to listen to those recommendations instead of saying, no, we know how to do it better. And so the best example I can give you of that is this. Take Cigna, take United, and take Aetna. They're huge, right? Every one of them has gone out and bought at least one independent TPA. United purchased UMR out of Cincinnati about 3 or 4 years ago. Now they've purchased several, and they go by Fiserv now. But the UMR one is the best example I can give you. UMR is an independent TPA, was an independent TPA down in Cincinnati. They used rental network structures and those kinds of things. They weren't accessing any of the BUCA networks because it didn't exist at the time. But they were so successful that by the time they were sold, they were turning down clients that were under 1,000 employee lives because they didn't need that volume. I'd love to be in that position to say, an 800-man group is not important to me anymore. Okay, I'm only selling to 1,000 and above. Fast forward 3 years, what has happened? UMR, in philosophy, doesn't exist anymore. They turned it into United, because United said, we know how to do it better, and they've lost a lot of key accounts. And United thought, or part of the process was, if we sell our national network to them, that will be so much better, they'll stick with us, and they'll stay with us. It wasn't true. Many of those employers said, we like the flexibility. We're willing to pay a little bit more sometimes in our discounts for our network because they're doing other things for us overall that our employees are happier. So I would remind you, if you go out and pull in some of that expertise from the TPA world, listen to them. Don't underestimate the expense and time to customize plan designs. That is probably the thing that caught us off guard more than anything else. As a health plan, you're used to putting in a new benefit plan every year, or not a new benefit plan, maybe 10 or 20 new benefit plans every year, or modifying those things. But once you put them in, you audit them, they're pretty much locked in stone and they don't change, right? Every time you bring on a self-funded client, they have a brand new plan, You've seen components of it, but you haven't seen that exact same plan unless they were one of your fully insured clients and said, take plan ABC that we are today and turn that into a self-funded plan. Now, I will give you an example of one of our own weaknesses at SumaCare. And I, like we've said here, we're among friends, so I don't mind sharing this with you. I thought, the broker thought, the employer thought, you've already got the plan. This should be a no-brainer. You'll switch it from December 31st to January 1, from fully insured to self-funded. What I learned in February and March is that is as if we never had configured the benefit plan in our system whatsoever. And what I learned in our system, or the way we had set it up, is that those were two totally different entities that when they were going to attach to keywords to pay a claim, that crossover didn't occur from fully insured to self-funded, and that they should have reconfigured the entire plan again into the self-funded side. And I thought, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. I will never share that with the client because it looks like we don't know what we're doing. And in fact, we didn't. So you got to be careful what your system limitations are, because you may think, this is an easy transition, just like I did. So don't underestimate that whole customization of plan designs. And then the audit work that goes on every year at renewal, and they can make changes throughout the year and those things, and they have bargaining unit contracts that may come in and affect a benefit year. So don't underestimate that. And then are you willing to invest in the capability of technology to produce those reports, or do you outsource that? A few more key points here. This is what I found interesting in Willis Towers Watson, is that the next 3 points are basically the same thing, but it's said a different way. So 91% of all the employers they surveyed said competitiveness of your total cost of care capabilities. So at the top, of course, provider discounts, your health management programs, so whatever that continuum of services may be, your gaps in care capabilities, which I think is interesting because that's usually more associated with Medicare programs for keeping your star ratings and those kinds of things, but it's getting out into the commercial world that our employees are better served if you start closing those gaps in care. So I think employers are becoming more sophisticated. You don't hear, usually don't hear a fully insured client say, what are you doing to close the gaps in care? It's how much of a renewal price did I get this year? Is it 3%? Is it 8%? Okay, we move forward. So again, there's a higher level of involvement by these self-funded employers. And then member engagement, getting their members. Even these large companies don't want to spend a lot of their budget on some of these, no offense to HR areas, but they don't put as much money into some of their HR areas, so they're trying to transition some of this to you as their administrator. And so if you can help them with engagement, if you can help them to educate their members and be part of that process, do some of the marketing material, the write-ups for them, they get excited about that. So that's the other part of this. How much are you willing to do, act as an extension of their HR department? How much of the collateral material are you willing to write? How much of the health fairs are you willing to do? Those kinds of things. The next area said 90% competitiveness of the negotiated provider discounts. I don't know how those two are different, but they're basically, those are what they reported. So they keep coming back to discounts. And then they said 84% your ability to lower the cost of care through health management, medical management. So the first three, as you can imagine, are all about the claims cost. But I will tell you, my experience has been, and if you have a different experience, please share it with me. We all say that 85% of a self-funded plan is the claims expense, right? And 15%, or now as I've heard as low as 12 or 10%, is the administrative fee. The irony is, when they're sitting down and do that RFP, they're evaluating you almost solely on your administrative fees. They're taking a 3-year time horizon to look at what did you put down for those administrative fees. And I think that the piece you've got to look at, or I would recommend you look at, is that you can't get away from the RFP process, but you've got to start picking some key select brokers. And some may say, well, this is more of sales versus operations. And I would tell you, if you don't sell, you don't have operations. If you don't have operations running properly, you won't sell. So they're tied together, right? So you've got to work with some key brokers and convince them of a different mindset and find out what they're looking for when they put their RFP out. And how can you position that administrative fee to show value when that's all they're evaluating on the initial front of it, so that the broker, when he's going, he or she is going over that RFP with the client, that they're also talking about, here's what they do on the clinical side as well. So you need an advocate in the room, because you will not be invited into the room for the RFP. You may be invited to the room to do a presentation as a finalist, but you've got to get those brokers, those consultants on your side to tell your story that says they're going to give more information than just what's on that RFP. So that's why you got to help bring that cost of care down, or help work with that administrative component, even though it's only 15%. And then this last one, 65% said willingness to partner with third parties. They're looking for price transparency, high performance networks, and health management vendors. So even though they're talking about discounts for the first three, they're also looking for high performance networks. Well, usually a high performance network is code for narrow network, right? And so you've got to convince the brokers, as they work with their employers, that this narrow high performance network is going to give enough coverage for that employer base, and so therefore they don't need this big national PPO network. So that's a challenge that we as provider sponsored plans have, or regional plans, is that one of the challenges I faced with trying to work with a Buca rental network is they always wanted to do the medical management included in that fee for network access. Well, that was something we were not willing to give up. We were not willing to give away the medical management, disease management, when the employer wanted to purchase it. We were not willing to transfer that to one of the Bucas. And so that's why we could never use a Buca network. So you've got to take that into account as well. So then, as you put your strategy together for whether or not this is a product line, you want to say, why are we doing this? Is it simply a financial exercise? Are we simply saying, if we add 10 more units, the price per unit will drop every time we add a new unit? And I know that's what some health plans do. And so they don't view this as a product line, and therefore they don't put the right investment towards that product line. Think about a Medicare Advantage plan. If you're in a Medicare Advantage, that gets people's attention, because I don't know what marketplace you know, you're what I call the old AAPCs, or the capitation amount. Let's just use $800 a month per member. Well, that's a lot of money to get people's attention. So you start saying, okay, what do we have to invest to make sure we administer this properly? What's the investment we have to do on compliance, because CMS is so onerous? Because that's an $800 PMPM, most plans take a look at that. When they say, well, self-funded, there's no claim risk, no liability risk, and we can only charge $20 to $25, how hard can it be, right? So sometimes the value of the service is determined erroneously on what it's priced at. But when you consider one of our clients, Cleveland Clinic, 26,000 employees, even at $25 a month times 26 times 12, that's a pretty hefty revenue stream, and there is no claim liability. And if you can eke out a 10% profit margin on that, that goes a long way to reinvest back into that product. Sometimes that money gets reinvested into other products because they have a bigger PMPM. So you've got to make that decision as well. What are we going to do with this plan, with this product? And then here, how are we going to position it? Is it simply in our regional footprint, or are we going to sell this product outside of our regional footprint? And if we sell it outside of our regional footprint, how do we do that? And so I know there's going to be discussions about networks and things like that, but there's, you know, Multiplan. We've worked with Multiplan over the years. There are regional networks that are out there as well. There's multiple ways to accomplish it, and the goal is, again, it can't always come down to discount. You've got to do a good job of working with the consultants to say, in this marketplace where you have the majority of your employees, this is the best network for them, and we have the best clinical services. And by the way, your employees are going to love the service we provide, because they're not going to come to your HR department. The more your those HR departments don't know about you as a company, the better off you are. I mean, you want to be the most unknown entity at that organization, because things are running well. Things are running smoothly. There's no discussion here. Maybe I'm not doing a very good job of getting discussion from the last one. So I'm not trying to lecture. I'm just trying to say, here are my observations. What kind of questions do you have? Kevin.
Keith, knowing what we went through at SumaCare, I think part of the decision-making process when you look at footprint or markets you want to be in from a TPA perspective is philosophically, what does your health system want you to do?
Correct.
If it's a profit center, do you take it nationwide or elsewhere, or is it just a feeder? So that's a real decision-making process from a health system perspective as a provider on health plan.
I agree. That's a good point.
Why do you think it is that there's not as much emphasis on discount? Do you think they...
Most of the emphasis is on discount, so I'm sorry.
Oh, I thought that you said you made an earlier point that they were basing the decision on the ASO fees.
So here's what I'm saying. If you go back to the survey, the first three items they said all were in the 90%. It basically said, give me the best discount in the provider network. That's where the employer says they place most of their emphasis, yet my comment was, where they make the evaluation is on the administrative fees when they're doing the RFP review. So even though they want the discount, the deepest discount, they don't act consistent with their survey question because they evaluate the RFP more heavily than they do the medical claims cost.
And why do you think that is?
I think it's easier. They've got a spreadsheet. They've got certain line items. It's like bank fees. Do I want overdraft? No, I don't want overdraft because that costs me $25. Do I want... online services, well, that's free now, but at one point it wasn't free. So they can sit there and say, here are all the things that we have to pay every month. We hope our claims costs will come down.
Yeah, do you think there's distrust of what the carriers report for their discounts?
Well, I can answer that two ways. I can give you my personal opinion, and then I can give, my personal opinion is, in the back of their mind, they do distrust, okay? But at the end of the day, the other part of this is they keep asking and asking and asking for that data, and they don't get it very well. I mean, they get more on the self-funded side, don't get me wrong, than if they were fully insured. But at the end of the day, you're at the mercy of what they'll give you. And so sometimes you say, I'm just sticking here. It's not that broken, and this is a painful process to switch to a new administrator. That's the other part of this. Once you gain a client, unless you really mess up, you've got them for 3 to 4 years because they don't want to move. But if you mess it up, they will move it. That's the other part of this. There's less willingness to move to another administrator when you're a 300-400 employee group versus a 5-man fully insured group because you can terminate tomorrow and get a new plan the next day.
Keith, would you say that when you're working with self-funded employers, data is important, reporting is important. It's now it's theirs, and they need to know about that. And on the fully insured side, they don't. But even when you're looking at the self-funded side, isn't that still part of the problem, that even though you do more reporting on that side, we're not doing enough to show the client the details at the end of the year of their claim cost? We give them the reports they need, but we don't really give them the detail to show them, here's where your claim costs were down compared to last year and all that. Or is that not accurate?
So I would modify that, Alex, and I'd say it this way. I have seen literally reports this thick from self-funded administrators, and you just plop it on there and say, quantity is value, right? You hope that they say, this is impressive because I didn't get anything before. Now I have a 300-page report, right? I think the difference is finding that meaningful data and putting, have all the data to support it for the data wonks that are out there, because some of these people want to go through that stuff. But the majority of them simply say, give me a 3 to 10-page executive summary, point out the key elements for me that are not working well, and tell me how we're going to get to a point of improving that. And I think that's the biggest challenge is taking, again, you've got to make that investment. If you're simply saying, we're going to take borrowed time from Bill and Susie to work on this product, you don't make the investment on digging into that informatics. And I think this is requires an investment on the informatics side or partnering with a company that can go in and data mine that, pull it out, and help you produce it in a meaningful manner. And then you want to get your CMO involved, I believe, your CMO and some clinical folks to help narrate a story. And I always wanted to take, for large clients, and I would sometimes say a 300-person group was a large client, try to take my CMO out there. Because how many of the BUCAs will take a CMO or your VP of healthcare management services out to the client to explain the clinical issues. That's another value add that you can bring to the table that the BUCAs don't provide them.
When the comments made, you know, why are you, are they focusing on the admin charges? I agree with you, it's easier. And the other side is, it's really hard to prove that a claim didn't occur, i.e. on
Correct.
The medical management side. And we've all had some experiences with, I call it creative writing in the ROIs on some of the things that have been implemented. So you have, it's really difficult. You know, just absolute discounts are probably the easiest. But I always, we had a saying, 2x40 is better than 1x70. So yeah, I'll give you a good discount, but you know, if the utilization is higher than the,
right.
the discount, you're still farther ahead. But it's really hard to demonstrate that medical management piece, and yet that is the key.
It is, and I think part of it is, you know, the statement was made earlier in the previous presentation, putting some of your administrative fees at risk. My attitude, and again, we're among friends. I'm a numbers guy. I'm not a traditional sales guy, so you have to understand that background. So when I say, when working with my CFO, he didn't want to put administrative fees at risk, and my attitude was, if we're doing the job right, what do we care? Because we're never going to pay those out. And so that kind of gives you a telltale sign of how you're doing as an organization. And I said, we should be promoting in every RFP, here's our set of service level agreements or key performance indicators from an administrative side. And I said, we should peg 25% of that to be at risk. Again, 25% of $20 is not the same as 25% of $800. And so sometimes that mindset doesn't make that transition. So that's the other part of this. You've got to realize that there's this mindset of dealing with fully insured, and you're thinking 25% of fully insured is a lot of money. Why would we put that at risk? Well, you know, again, if you're doing the job well, I don't expect you to be perfect, and the client doesn't expect you to be perfect. And the other part of this is the client doesn't want you to pay back those administrative fees. They just want you to do your job, but this is the way they feel they can hold you accountable, right? So if you're willing to put that out there, that gives them a lot more sense of confidence that you're doing it. And if you as an organization want to promote that, that means you're taking more oversight on what you're doing from an operations perspective, because you're saying, hey, we don't ever want to pay any of these service level agreements out. And so that's one component. And where that's migrating to is starting to give them clinical key performance metrics. And I know that's much harder to do, but maybe it's, we will help you reduce your ED visits by 5 a month or something. If we don't, this is what we'll do. I mean, that's the way to start getting their attention, is helping them to understand, yes, there's the admin side, and that's what you evaluate, but can you give them one or two clinical metrics that you really can manage well? I mean, I had a coalition president from in Ohio sit across the table from me and said, look, I've got 3 large clients. If you're willing to put on paper 2 or 3 clinical items that you define as a health plan that you'll go at risk for, that my client will measure you by, and they'll commit to the next 3 years. They don't expect you to hit the target in year one, but we'll work together for 3 years. I couldn't get the clinicians to agree on what those 2 or 3 items should be on the piece of paper. And no offense to my friends and the clinicians, but that was a new mindset. I mean, think about it. These are folks that build things, they purchase materials, and they have in their standard contracts the pureness of the materials they're buying, the milling of that diameter of that piece of metal that they're putting into that product. So they're used to this. This is a natural concept for them. And I was frustrated that we couldn't get together and say, here are the 2 or 3 that we developed, and they're willing to do this for the next 3 years. Still haven't gotten there. It's difficult for me to understand that concept, but that's what I'm saying. These performance metrics start on the administrative side, but you'll be better served if you can migrate some over to the clinical side and put that in your RFP. That'll start getting people's attention, and I believe you can actually start charging more administrative fees. Now, that's opinion. You have to look at your marketplace, but I believe, and like I said, this president said, they'll commit for 3 years if you're willing to do this. Kevin.
Most of what you're talking about now relates to me, relates to pretty sophisticated accounts, you know, looking at the data, mining the data, changing the benefits, quality management, things of that nature. In this pretty volatile environment, as it shifts down, self-funding is now going down to small groups, 50, 25, all sorts of numbers that I could never get an underwriter to back up or consider. Where's the cutoff point where the sophistication ends and the escape from benefit mandates begins?
I'm sure, I guess I'm not.
For small groups, so as you descend in the group size,
right?
Isn't there more emphasis on just cost, period, and not so much on quality or metrics or reporting?
You know, again, my opinion only, even on the small side, yes, they're clearly looking for cost savings because for all employers, regardless of size, their employee benefit expense is either the first or second line item, right, on their income statement of expense. I mean, it's very, very expensive. And so it's even probably more impactful for a smaller group that's just struggling to get by. But I think they always want that quality, and so they want to keep their employees out of their office, whether that's the HR office, whether that's the president's office saying, my plan's not working well. So I still believe good service, the wow factor, as I call it, is still important regardless of size. The challenge with size, the smaller size, I would ask you to work with your actuary to say, what's the small size we'd go down to start putting some of those clinical factors out there? Because you clearly can't do it in a 25-person group. But can you pull a certain block of that self-funded book of business and give a overall type of one or two clinical metrics that make sense for that block of business? But that's something that you'd clearly want to look at with your actuaries. I would say if you can implement that, it's not that big of a deal compared to the 300, 400-person group that's looking for that clinical support, even though they evaluate it on the financial side. So some of the services that you need to decide that you will provide is what I call core services, or whether they're ones that you're partner with. So, you know, and this is in no particular order, but I can't imagine, you know, the claims adjudication, whether it's medical pharmacy, most people outsource to a PBM. I know Providence owns their own PBM, so that's more of, I would say, an exception. But however you do that, you got to think of both of those. Customer service providers, I mean, I'm not going to read you the laundry list of things, but you got to think about like network management, what I call the primary local footprint. We're going to have that network discussion later. The primary outside local footprint. How do you do the wrap? How do you do the travel? How do you convince this client that knows you only as a regional health plan, that they are headquartered in your location, they like local, they want you to do well, they want you to succeed, but guess what? They've got 30 employees scattered over the country. Those employees are just as important to them as the 300 that are located locally. How are you going to take care of them, and how are you going to keep their costs down? Now, I've observed that they don't expect you to have the deepest discounts on those 30 as long as you can manage the block that's over here. So you've got to think about that and say, we can take care of you locally, and this is, you know, make some admissions that say, you're not going to get the same discount as one of the BUCAs in those 30 areas, but we've got this, and we can still manage that properly because we're doing a better job of care management, case management, closing gaps of care. You've got to create that value for that out-of-network, out-of-area piece. And that's another consideration when you're going into this. Understand that even though you think they're all local, there's always going to be vacation and business and all those things. How are you going to cover that? And that's one of the reasons why I think the BUCA networks are doing so well. It's easy. They think it's a nationwide network. Well, they've got gaps in care. They're going out and using other rental networks as well to cover those gaps in care also. So, or the coverage. So they just don't broadcast it. They just say, we're a national carrier and we have a national network. You can't say that because they know you're regional. So you got to take that into account when evaluating this. The benefit configuration, do you hire that team internally? Do you outsource that to somebody? Client services, I'm a firm believer you never give that away to anybody else. That's something you would want to do. And so the list of other things over here. Are there any questions on this? And why, or does it make sense that do you think you have to do all these? Or are there, how do you evaluate which ones you outsource, which ones you do in-house? Again, I'm trying to generate a thought process here to help you think about it as you go down this process or already in it.
I'd just like to make a comment. It was kind of about the gentleman was talking about, is everybody just interested in cost? And I think in the first presentation, the big gap between the lines points on your graph. Michael Porter said in 2006 that in our industry, it's like this sea of opportunity because we can actually improve quality and lower cost at the same time. In most industries, quality costs money. In ours, by raising quality, we actually can lower costs. So I think even to a small group employer, if you can demonstrate an improvement in cost, lowering of cost, but at the same time show them they got a better quality product, I think we have both of those things going for us.
And I think what's helpful to that, too, is I would recommend that you put together a list of things of what quality means so you can share that with the employer. I'm a firm believer that every employer believes that when they go to a provider, whoever it is, that provider is providing quality. We may not view it that way, and physicians and providers may not view it that way, and so they want to stand on, look at our quality score, we're number two in the country, we're number one in the country. The average person thinks every provider they go to provides quality. Otherwise, they wouldn't really keep going to that provider, would they? And so to say we had the best clinical quality, I think you need to turn around in other ways.
Hey, Keith. Yeah. I would just add at this point here, too, with all the information up there, somebody had mentioned SIA as being a good resource for self-funding. Another organization that I would put out there is SPBA.
SPBA, exactly.
Yeah, it's a very technically dedicated organization to TPAs. Members are TPAs and stop-loss entities.
Right.
You go to those meetings, you're going to get a good feel for what the TPA side of the world is doing, and they provide a lot of good information on a lot of the technical stuff specifically related to this information. So I'd put that out there if you're not familiar with that.
Yeah. SPBA, Society Professional Benefit Administrators, yeah. SPBA. They're headquartered in D.C. We belong to that. I view it akin to this organization. You go, you actually get good information. You don't get a lot of commercials. No offense to our sponsors. I'm not trying to imply that we don't need sponsors and stuff. But it's people talking about their own experience, and they're willing to share with each other, even though they compete with each other. They're very willing to share best practices. Tom?
Keith, just the only comment I wanted to make about ASO services. You know, a lot of regionals, whether it's in this room or not in this room, but they outsource their claims somewhat right now.
Right.
And one of the problems you see is the lack of flexibility within those systems. And if you look at an ROI proposition, sometimes it's better to outsource it to someone that really has a vibrant, a lot of flexibility.
Correct.
And create more margin that way, perhaps,
right,
than trying to do it yourself and spending all the resources to do it and maybe not making a margin.
Correct. I mean, so just one quick example of that, and I know I'm standing between us and lunch, and I'm not going to do that. We took our claim system. Won't mention the name of it. You all have your own claim system. They all have their quirks. We know that. We had our claim system. We said, this is fantastic. We can do so many things. It's so flexible, blah, blah. Look at all the millions of dollars we spent on it. Well, you know, one of the things it can't do, and it's very common in the self-funded world, it cannot put the date on the check to the provider after the claims have been funded by the employer. So we refuse, and we refuse to release claims monies until the client has funded it. Now, there are some entities out there that will pre-fund it and try to collect it. We wouldn't go down that path. I'm not going to put out $1 million and I'm collecting $100,000 in admin. I just can't make that offset very well. So we would run the claim run every Friday, print the checks with the date on it. And if the employer didn't pay for 3 weeks, we're mailing out checks that are 3 weeks old. And I said, this is stupid. This just doesn't make sense. So, I mean, it's that kind of, don't think that your system can do all the things that are logical. So there may be an opportunity to outsource that at first because there are entities that have those systems that can do those types of things. Ancillary services. You know, this is much more of an unbundled, you know, you saw the Greek menu concept. You know, what are you going to do about nurse line? Wellness. And this wellness area has really evolved a lot more. More employers are accepting to do wellness without a return on investment. So, you know, to my friends who are in the finance department, I understand you've got to figure out where to put these limited resources. But a lot of employers are now moving, and we're using the term value on investment. So they're saying it's the right thing to do. It helps us. We believe it's helping us to lower our costs. So don't think that they're not going to be looking at you to say, can you provide these services for me? So if you say, yeah, in our local market, we can do biometric testing. We've got a lab that's happy to do all those tests. What do you do for the employee that's sitting 10 states away? Those kinds of things. So I would just ask you to look at that. Do you, you know, do these internally? Do you outsource these?
Just a quick question on you had stop loss up there previously, and that seems to be, you know, one of the challenges for smaller plans. What are your thoughts on sort of whether or not you keep that insourced or you you decide to partner for it? Is it just scale at some point that if you have
so a lot of
scale,
it is risk appetite, to be blunt. Right. And I would say if you're starting up in the self-funded world, you'd be crazy to do your own stop loss, if that's what you're referring to. There are a lot of good stop loss partners in the room. You can work with them. They're very willing to help you get started. They take the risk, and then they can help develop a plan to migrate you, that as you're starting to grow and get scale and you want to take on more risk, you can start doing quota shares and different things like that. But I think right out of the gate, that's not an investment you need to make because you just don't have the financial wherewithal to do that. So you partner with some good stop loss carriers. These are areas that might be areas of potential conflict because most of us, if not all of us, are owned by health systems, right? So, or some type of provider form. So one of the things that's very common is centers of excellence now. Can you carve out and we want to do all our hearts at XYZ? We don't want to run it through your network. Well, maybe your health system thinks they're the best heart program in town, and they say, no, we're not going to do centers of excellence, okay? Because we are the center of excellence. So you've got to take some of that into account. On-site health clinics. I will tell you now, moving down to South Carolina, the health system that I'm working with, they don't have a health plan, but they've been doing what they call business health. They have 36 health clinics in the community already that they put nurse practitioners on-site and do different things, various hours. These on-site health clinics don't have to always be physician-led. They can be obviously physician-supervised, but are you willing to do that, or is that something your organization says, we just don't have the money to invest in that? So you got to take that into account. Pricing transparency tools, I believe, is the biggest tension. As somebody said, I think Steve said, nobody wants to be seen in their underwear, so your parent company, are they willing to put out there, this is what it costs to do a knee, this is what it costs to do a hip compared to the competition? Employers are asking for price transparency, and I think that's one of the biggest conflicts we have. Telemedicine. Maybe your system doesn't want to do telemedicine because it competes with the PCPs. They want the volume to go to the PCPs at the brick and mortar. More and more employers are asking for telemedicine. Account-based health plans. You know, Steve talked about that. I've heard CFOs of different health systems say, you cannot do account-based health plans because our bad debt will skyrocket and I can't afford that. I mean, that's, you wouldn't hear that from Abuka, right? And so you've got to take that into account as part of this overall strategy, those kinds of things that they're looking for. And then this is the dichotomy. One-stop shopping, some employers say, I want to come to you and do most of the services here. The next one, they believe that the best way to do this is what they call best in class, and so they have multiple third-party vendors. I'm talking to a potential client in Greenville right now, and we're talking about doing a CIN, direct-to-employer strategy with our CIN network and putting some things at risk that we're talking about. So that's why I'm saying that's what I'm doing down there, not working with a health plan. They have 30 different vendors for their employee benefit plan. 30 different vendors. I think that's extreme. But that's what they have. And so whoever the administrators, they've got to work with how do you plug and play those 30 different vendors. And so part of this multiple vendor is that creates vendor summits. Well, if you don't want to be that multiple third-party vendor model, help create some vendor summit, or not vendor summits, but create summits with your employers. Show them the creativity and the collaboration you're willing to do, because that's part of why they want to have multiple vendors. They think they're getting different ideas from different organizations that see different things across the country.
Can I have you back up just for a minute on the account-based health plan? Can you explain that a little more?
That's the consumer-directed health plan, okay. So HSA or HRA plan.
Okay, fine.
And then corporate mindset for soft services by clients. The biggest one is wellness. These are things that are going on. That's why I talked about the value add. And so they're not using ROI as much anymore. I mean, and how much are you willing to get involved with this? Such as, are you willing to help them with physical challenges? Do you have a tool that they can monitor those physical challenges? More and more employers are looking for gamification capabilities in their wellness system so that they engage their employees to go out and do different things online to get them engaged in their health and their wellness. A lot of employers are saying, okay, we want to improve the healthcare. We're going to put bicycle stands on our campus to encourage them. Are you going to maybe sponsor a bike at their location? You know, I've been to, where is it, Boston? I see Blue Cross bikes everywhere. They sponsor those things like crazy. The social media. you know, this whole thing, what part of this are you going to do? What part are you not going to do? Are you willing to plug and play with those different vendors? Goodyear was a client of mine. Well, they still are of SumaCare, and they've branded it Good Life. Their whole wellness system is called Good Life. Their CMO was responsible for developing the menu in their cafeteria. I mean, that's the level of getting involved in this whole wellness piece. And so you've got to, I think, take that into account and say, here's the value we can bring, not just administrative services. And that's the end of my presentation.